Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Donald Trump's marginalizing and fear-baiting of domestic and foreign Muslims is so similar to the anti-Semitism inflicted upon Jews, and it has got me reflecting on authors and their expressions and representations of non-Western, non-white, non-Christian characters and narratives. In my time producing, along with host Rosemary Manchester, and now myself hosting this program, I have occasionally interviewed authors that I just didn't know what to make of, or who didn't express themselves in an easily accessible way. After all, we live in a time of immediacy and sound bites. However, here at KRCB and NPR, we strive to expose our listeners to a little bit more. So today I bring you a conversation that I wasn't sure of and that I didn't know how to package. So today I've decided not to package it at all. I hope you will listen with the clear-headed and curious ears that you, our listeners, are known for. Judgment, persecution, and prejudice destroy our ability to enjoy and appreciate the colorful differences and ultimate similarities of our species beyond race or religion. Stay tuned. It's a novel idea. Wishnia is a Jewish writer, and his novels and short stories are so inflected. He has recently published Jewish Noir, which Suspense magazine has named Best Anthology of 2015. It is a unique collection of stories by Jewish and non-Jewish literary and genre writers, including numerous award-winning authors such as Marge Piercy, Harlan Ellison, S.J. Roseanne, and many more. The stories explore such themes as the Holocaust and its long-term effects on subsequent generations, anti-Semitism in the mid and late 20th century United States, and the dark side of the diaspora. Imbued in these stories is the history of prejudice and the contradictions of ethnic identity and assimilation into American society. I spoke with Wishnia a couple of years ago when his book, The Fifth Servant, was released. I share that conversation with you today. He is a genre writer of mystery novels and short stories. He persevered through the maze of the publishing world to acclaim for his series featuring NYPD cop Philomena Buscarcella, and The Fifth Servant is a period crime fiction set in 16th century Prague. On the eve of Passover in 1592, a young Christian girl is found murdered in a Jewish shop, causing panic for Christians and Jews alike. I now bring you my conversation with Kenneth Wishnia. Welcome to Sonoma County. Happy to have you here today. I'm here with Kenneth Wishnia, and upon the publication of your latest book, The Fifth Servant, but you've recently had a whole series of books reissued by PM, correct?
Yes, to bring out five novels in all.
You are a crime writer, yes, and that's... Your new book might be a little bit of a departure from that, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but I don't know.
right. Well, I guess one thing I do is that this series actually covers about 20 years of her life, so it is the early 80s, but time does pass. You know, they are grounded in the historical, and so, you know, Reagan is president in the first one, George H.W. Bush is president in the second, somebody named Clinton, I forget, is president in the third. And there was actually a gap in the manuscript for several months in the fall of 2000 while I waited to find out who the hell was president, you know, in the fourth novel in the series. So in that sense, no, very much, you know, politically grounded.
And framed in a certain point in time. And so, well, since we've already mentioned your books, and why don't you tell us because I don't want to be my pronunciation to be the first one our listeners hear the main character who we're following through these books.
Sure, yes. Her name is Filomena Buscarcella. She's an Ecuadorian-American female detective, and obviously one of the first questions is, where on earth did that come from? And so I'll say in 1986, I got married to an Ecuadorian woman, and we moved to Ecuador and lived there for a couple of years. And, you know, I'd been planning to write a crime novel, you know, featuring, you know, yes, this troubled, disturbed cop in the early 80s of when New York was still a mess. I mean, a real mess, recovering from, well, not yet recovering from the bankruptcy of the mid-70s. And actually, one of my wife's friends was named Filomena. I like that name. And then I sometimes have fun with transparent names, meaning that, you know, in that language, it actually means something. And, you know, Buscarcella is not a real last name. It's a Buscar is the verb to look, to search for. So, of course, that was perfect for a detective. But in Ecuador and other Latin American countries, Buscarcella means look for trouble. You know, watch it. You're looking for trouble. So that was the perfect name for a Latino detective. And I guess, you know, I mean, Michael Connelly, the best-selling author, once said, you know, you're not supposed to write about how the detective works on the case. It's really about how the case works on the detective. And you mentioned flawed. I would say extremely flawed. But, you know, one thing I always do, especially in the first novel, but I try to do that, is, you know, yes, there's her day job, which is beat cop in the first one, though not in the others. Then there's the case, and then there's her personal life. And these all are intertwined, and, you know, that is different. I think recently there's a lot more of a trend towards, you know, thrillers that, oh, yes, the personal life of the investigators is much more important. But, you know, certainly classical, polite crime fiction, you know, it's always just, you know, Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot doesn't change across 50 years.
Right,
and, you know,
right.
Dozens of novels.
Do you think that that's kind of a hallmark of where we are at right now in this genre? Because I notice that there's a lot of, I'm going to call it contemporary crime fiction.
Sure.
And I will make a full confession here. It's not a genre that I am steeped in like some people are, as you see them walking down the street reading the book.
Well, I would agree with that. I say certainly contemporary. There's much more emphasis on the personal life of the detective, and people do expect to see growth and change in the novels, and, you know, relationships develop or end and or come back.
And that there is this threading through of our culture and cultural events that give the books an immediacy when we as readers have touchstones within a book, even though it is a deep fiction in a way, like these are. But tell me about what it takes for you as a writer to sustain a character through, is it five books now?
This series, yes, and then about a half dozen short stories. So the character... The character arc really does go from about 1983 to 2008. I mean, she's, you know, a wild and crazy woman in her 20s in the first novel, a much more responsible single mom, a result of her wildness and
craziness.
Are
you growing up with her? I mean, you as a writer, I mean, if you've been writing with her, or she's been your subject for Right. A long time now, huh?
Right. No, I would definitely say so. She was a little older than me when I started writing her. Now she's a little younger than me, I think. But yeah, I mean, as I say, she goes from, you know, in the second novel, she's a single mom. In the third, you know, the child is about 3 and a half. In the fourth, there's a leap, and the child is 12. By the last short story, you know, she's a high school student. And yeah, we're in, you know, the contemporary era, like the 2008 election has sort of already stopped.
You find her compelling.
Well, she's my alter ego, so yes, it's easy to have that. And since she does react to events that are really out there, I certainly want to say that, you know, nobody wants to read a political tract disguised as a novel, but certainly, you know, I was brought up in an academic, you know, Marxist intellectual family, so no one wants, as I say, they don't want to have a political tract inserted into a novel,
but it's
certainly
in you.
But the novel has to be grounded in a political reality. And actually, you know, I can quote no less an authority than George Orwell, who in his essay Why I Write concludes at the end that it was, you know, whenever I lacked a political purpose, I wrote drivel. So, hey, that's something to aspire to. But yeah, you know, you don't want to just, as I said, you don't want to like cut and paste a pamphlet and drop it into your novel.
Yeah, yeah. But it sounds like it's something that's fairly in your DNA, and it would be unusual if it didn't inform your work.
Or even just, as I say, more mundane things in terms of, well, not mundane for us, but, you know, for example, you know, you mentioned, you know, so many people you see reading genre and you don't. But, you know, there is a reason that, well, frankly, in any genre, a lot of it really is low-level stuff. But the best of any genre is as good as anything that's produced in the literary world. I mean, I think, you know, Dashiell Hammett's novels, especially from the 1920s, he's doing the same thing Hemingway was doing. But, you know, Hemingway gets all the, you know, all the applause for it. But, you know, just for example, you know, it's such a familiar motif that, oh, the private investigator, you know, naturally the office is in a crappy part of town, and when she walks into her office, oh, there's a bunch of bills there. And I've read so many novels where, oh, she just takes them and throws them in the garbage. You know, gee, I wish I could do that with my bills, but I actually have to pay them, you know. And then, you know, her car is some crappy, you know, 20-year-old vehicle that she's two payments behind on. Yet, you know, what bothers me about those, so it's not, you know, they're going for an image that has been established before, but it's just the surface of it, because, or superficiality of it, because, you know, I pick up on the fact that, and yet this private investigator has a bottomless source of money to give to informers, and, oh, just peeling off 20s and hundreds, you know. So, oh, you live in this crappy town, and you're three payments behind on the crappy car, but you're handing out hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
I want that job in
bribe money, and so that's what I mean. You know, yeah. In one of the novels, actually, well, I'm jumping ahead, but in the fifth novel in the series, when she actually goes back to her native Ecuador and really has to go into deep hiding, off the grid completely, kind of. And, you know, she really says, I've got my credit card in my shoe, but if I use it, it's going to send this signal where I am. And she really is down to like 20 cents. And what do you do? And, you know, in that, so, you know, if that's political, call me political. But, you know, yeah, I do find there is this magical wallet that these PIs have that just keeps producing money.
The joy of living in a novel of someone else's creation. So for our readers, there are five books in the series, and I think for readers, reading books where there is a continuing character who has a continuing life is something to anticipate. There's always something to look forward to, especially when you build, as a reader, the relationship with those characters too, over time, and to see where they go. And certainly there's, a robust history of that through literature. But are you planning on keeping her going through more volumes? Where is she going next? Or you don't have to tell us because she's in hiding.
Well, certainly one thing I go for in the series is, you know, even though it is a series and, yes, it's chronological and many fans always want to start with the first one, you know, it's written so that you can read any one of them out of order. You know, you're not going to, I'm not going to give away stuff that, you know, at the ending of a previous novel or presume knowledge of her.
One can pick it up and then say, oh, I wonder what happened two books ago.
Sure.
Yeah.
And as I say, well, I'm leaping ahead, but, you know, it took me many years of research to write The Fifth Servant. And in fact, while I was working on it, I got a couple of invitations to submit to anthologies. So that's why Philomena continued in short stories up into the present. So, you know, I don't know about a future novel yet. We'll see, because I'm actually working on another Jewish themed historical, right? Jewish theme.
Well, why don't we move on and talk about that book? But I just want to remind the listeners that we're talking with Kenneth Wishnia, and you do have a website that you can find out more about him. But your first book, 23 Shades of Black, that introduces Philomena Buscarcela, is available now from PM Press. And PM Press. And it seems like you as an author have experienced a full spectrum of publication experiences because of being rejected, self-publishing, then being embraced, and now having all of your this whole mystery series freshly published. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about that from your perspective as the writer?
Yes, it's a great cautionary tale for all aspiring writers. On the one hand, it's uplifting, and the other hand, it's a good roller coaster to remind people. It's, as I say, I often tell them, if it can happen to me, it can happen to you. So just be prepared. Fortunately, I was a little bit, but yes, I actually, you know, I actually wrote the first draft of 23 Shades of Black on an electrical typewriter in the mountains of Ecuador because I had a computer, but this was in the late 80s, and the power in the mountains of Ecuador was inconsistent, unpredictable, and obviously with a computer you would have lost everything. So I actually typed it on an electric typewriter, switching to writing by hand when the power went out, which was pretty frequently. And then, you know, the second draft was, yes, done by modern computer technology. It was rejected by agents and editors for 9 years until I gave up on the notion of commercial publication, self-published it, and that was nominated for the Edgar Allan Poe Award. So, yes, my name is sort of in the self-published Hall of Fame. There is such a thing.
Well, I think, you know, and it's something on that we've talked with listeners and readers before about, that sometimes the world of publishing these days is all over the map, and there are lots of small presses that publish very fine works, and self-publishing is a whole different story than it used to be. It's no longer what you might call, I think, what years ago they called vanity publications. That's just not the case anymore. And I think you're a case in point where it your own persistence and your own work then really allowed you to emerge as a respected writer.
Well, yeah, there is a big difference, you know, now that basically anybody can self-publish. There are advantages to that, but there are disadvantages. You're going to get lost in the field. You know, yeah, this was in 1997, and, you know, I really had to actually print books and store them in the house. But, you know, I think a key thing is, let's say, well, back in the early 90s when I was still, you know, sending it out, and I had an agent at the time who, in fact, one morning I got a phone call from an editor at a major New York publishing house, and only after the fact did I realize how extraordinary that was. You know, they don't just call people up. I mean, obviously they were interested. And I guess I would say that nowadays there are lots and lots of strong female detectives and, you know, police officer and it's other protagonists. But really, you know, in the early 90s, there were very few. And so clearly you know, they saw potential. And she called me up and said, you know, we love this feisty female character and the gritty realism. There's just one thing. Cut the politics. And it was an earlier draft, so I actually said, I know just what you're talking about. There are a few passages where she kind of gets on a soapbox and gives a political speech. I will cut those. I'm trying to be accommodating. And I will never forget what she said, which was, oh, it's not a matter of a few passages. It's pretty much every sentence. You know, and I'm sitting there going like, you love the character and the gritty realism, but you want me to change every sentence. Yeah. And, you know, during the course of this conversation, you know, she wouldn't come right out and say it, but it was quite clear that what she meant was, you know, okay, we need, you know, tough female, you know, strong female characters are bae. We could all make tons of money, but what is this with the Ecuadorian woman stuff? You know, make her Jodie Foster from Iowa, a nice white girl from Iowa, and then we can, you know, we can sell more copies.
So that must have been kind of confusing for you, or was it confusing for you to have somebody say in a backhanded way maybe that you're a talented writer, that they liked a lot of elements, but essentially wanted you to completely write a different story or framed differently. Now,
exactly.
I mean, that must have put you in a position of, well, what position did it put you in? How about that?
Yeah, let me continue with that. So, yeah, at that point I said, well, you don't mean cut the politics. You mean change the politics. And, you know, she got this sort of like, oh, writers, you try to talk to them and, you know, what can you do with these people? And so, yeah, that is a big difference because, you know, it's essential to the character is she is an outsider. She doesn't fit in even within the Latino community. One of the reasons she's Ecuadorian, aside from my obvious connection to that culture, was it was perfect for me because she's even a minority within Latino culture in New York 20 years ago. Now there's, you know, a sizable Ecuadorian group in Corona, Queens, in fact. But back then, you know, she wouldn't have been. And so that's important. You know, if I made her this, you know, Jodie Foster character, and at one point they said, well, she said, you know, cut all that other stuff and stick to the story. And I said, that other stuff is the story, you know, that, you know, it's, you know, if you read the novel, my work is sometimes frustrating for, I guess, a lot of people who read a lot of genre love it because I do bend the rules or break them, invert them, and they love that. But there are a lot of people who are frustrated by my character because, yeah, it isn't like, oh, the body on page one and you follow the clues until – and then there's all these sort of digressions, but, you know, you end up with the solution at the end. And, you know, in my
case – Yeah, that is maybe two different kind of readers, one that has feels that they are comforted by the expectation of the form, and those who really dig going places that they didn't expect in the form. And obviously that's the latter are the type of readers who really enjoy your books.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, you know, like critics, you know, it's gotten very good. This series has gotten very good critical attention. You know, I made the Washington Post list of best mysteries of the year. I've made Library Journal's list. You know, four of my six novels have made somebody's best of the year. It's been nominated for three awards. And yet, yeah, you know, there's a difference between cutting the soapbox speeches and gutting it of all social content. That's something I refused to do. I basically opted to remain unpublished than to do that. And, you know, I guess it might have been different if they had pulled me out of the slush pile and groomed me and made a big hit out of me. And then I would have said, sure, yes, whatever you say, I'll do. But in fact, yeah, you guys rejected me for years. Mm-hmm. I had to print it myself and get nominated for an Edgar. And then I was snapped up by a big publisher who didn't know what to do with me. And that's why I say this is the cautionary part. It was sort of, oh, he just got nominated for the Edgar. Sign this guy up. And yeah, the first thing they started to say was, okay, you broke in by breaking all these rules, but now you're going to do it our way. And as I say, if they had found me and made me into something, I might have gone along with it. But it was sort of, no, you're the same morons who rejected me for years, and now you're going to tell me to start playing it your way? And, you know, the first thing they said was, well, she's got to stay a cop. I'm like, well, she's not a cop in the second book. Oh, okay. Well, she's got to stay in New York. Well, in the third one, she moves out to Long Island. You know, it was already written. And so, all of these, you know, writer, you must follow this formula kind of thing. Yeah.
You're making, just in your relaying of the story, you're really making an acute comment on the publishing industry or the mainstream publishing industry.
Certainly, yeah.
And for you as an author, I mean, certainly every author wants a high-end bestseller with the big billboards out front. Yet, how does one gauge success? Certainly, having a character who's sustained through this many books and the kind of acknowledgement you have received seems to me like a reward for your own tenacity and persistence and staying true to yourself as a writer.
Well, thank you. Yes, I agree. And, you know, coming out with PM Press is a great vindication of that because, you know, they're a perfect fit for me. They do socially conscious fiction. And
they were happy to have you.
Oh, yes. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to the rest of the series coming out because, you know, I will work for them promoting them because, you know, they've taken, you know, the time to invest in me.
And PM Press is Oakland-based.
Yeah, based in Oakland.
Press. Well, let's talk about your latest book, which here we've been talking about your Filomena Buscarcela series, which began with 23 Shades of Black, and now your latest book, and it's very contemporary crime fiction,
right.
And now this current book, The Fifth Servant, is an indie notable best Jewish book of one of the best Jewish
right.
books of 2010. That got my attention because I thought, hey, wait a minute, this sounds
very
like
different.
A left turn. And so tell us a little, and set in a completely different century, the 1500s. So what right. took you in this direction as a writer, as a person?
Sure. And it's also my first novel to actually win one of the awards. I've been nominated for 3 awards in the U.S., and the Italian translation won a literary award in Italy. So,
congratulations.
So viva Italia, that's all I have to say. And get with it, America. Come on. Yeah. Well, you know, in a way it actually reflects my life, obviously. But, you know, when I was about, you know, I come from this, you know, Marxist, atheist, academic intellectual family, and I was about to get married to a religious Latin Catholic. And so one of the things I said to myself was, you know, I need to learn about our culture. I'm going to read the New Testament. And I read it and had what I always call a reverse revelation. I realized that I knew everything of significance in the life of Jesus just by growing up in the U.S. You know, a man does not live by bread alone. Oh, one of you shall betray me. You know, come and I shall make you fishers of men. You know,
Jesus Christ Superstar did a lot for us.
Right, and all of that, you know, just by growing up in the U.S. You know, and I said to myself, gee, I might as well be Christian. I really don't know my own culture. I always say that again, in my parents' home, the main representatives of Jewish culture were bagels and Woody Allen movies, which is pretty good. You know, you can go pretty far on that. But so sort of a similar thing happened, you know, that with my first novels, you know, as I say, being married to an Ecuadorian woman was the perfect vehicle for making that exotic person from this specific culture, you know, a character. You know, no one had seen that, in fact. And so the shift to a Jewish-themed novel also reflects that you know, marrying a Catholic is what got me interested in Judaic studies. When I read the New Testament, I realized I was ignorant of the Old Testament, or what we say that we call the Hebrew Bible. And so I actually went to one of those religious stores in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and you know, and the guy working there was just straight from central casting, like just the yarmulke and the payas and the tzitzis, the fringe garment, and you know, he knew, you know, he could tell by looking at me with my unshaven face and short jacket, like, okay, you're an assimilated Jew. And I said, I want a Bible, a Hebrew Bible, you know, parallel Hebrew one side, English the other. And, you know, he pulls one down and this one, right? And I say how much. And he, again, to continue the central casting image, he really did say, for you, $20. And, you know, so during the first 2 years of our marriage down in Ecuador, I accompanied my wife to Mass every Sunday. I've been to more Masses than most American Catholics, I think. Not Latin Catholics. No, they're old school. They do it. But and I would sit there reading my Hebrew Bible, and I've got some funny stories about that too, if you want to hear about it. But I'm just saying that that trajectory is also paralleled in the work, that my first novels are written in the voice of this Ecuadorian-American Catholic religious woman. And as I was working on it, I gradually felt the pull of, you know, I got to write about a Jewish theme. You know, I'm doing this other thing because it's the perfect fit for what I wanted to say and do.
So what took you to the 16th century?
Sure. Well, a couple of things. One, again, my mom is a historian, and she's one of the founders of the Women's Studies program at SUNY Stony Brook, State University of New York at Stony Brook. And so, for example, in 1967, you know, my father got a sabbatical to work at the chemistry department at the University of Edinburgh. So we went from a small New England town to this, you know, city in Europe with a medieval castle in the center. And I was 6 years old, so I was just...
Obviously. Never left you.
Lots of fantasy there, and, you know, very impressive. And Edinburgh Castle is on volcanic rock, and it's just, you know, so impressive. But then in 1973-74, we went to Paris so that my mother could do the thesis research for her dissertation on French labor history. And so, yeah, you know, I went to a French high school at actually Lycée Henri IV. Voltaire went there. And, you know, the older part had like this 16th century marble staircase, 17th century probably, you know, that sort of thing.
So that sort of created in you just as a person this romance maybe about...
Well, I knew I always wanted to write some kind of medieval novel.
Yes.
But that's the important distinction. There is. I originally thought it would be the Middle Ages, so I was thinking maybe the 14th century, which was calamitous for the Jews. You know, lots of racial hatred. The plague, of course, hits Europe, and there is some evidence that because of the kosher laws and therefore somewhat more sanitary conditions in the Jewish parts of town, that the plague took longer to reach there. So, of course, all these, you know, ignorant people who are, you know, everyone's dying these horrible, painful, and, you know, foul-smelling deaths. You know, hey, the Jews aren't dying. Obviously, they must be trying to kill us. You know, it's their fault. And, you know, so a lot of that happened. But as I did the research, the Renaissance presented many more possibilities, gets much more complex because, of course, you know, anyone knows basic Western civ, they know that the distinction, one of the key distinctions between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance is the shift from, you know, land as the source of wealth to, oh, mercantile goods, capital, money. And so what you actually had in Prague in the 16th century, first of all, you had a very diverse body. Prague was the capital of Jewish Europe, largest Jewish population in Europe, but also because they're now the Czechs, but the Bohemians and the Hussites, they were, you know, called at the time, were the first successful major split from the Roman Catholic Church in the early 15th century. And apparently Rome sent, you know, a crusade. They called it a crusade against these heretics to destroy them. And, you know, well, they succeeded in defending themselves. And in fact, one of the heroic generals is named Žižka. So these, you know, I have the sheriff in the fifth servant is Žižka. So because of that experience, they were relatively tolerant. You know, this is the middle of the Catholic Counter-Reformation, the religious wars in Europe that devastated until 1648. You know, it's going on for over a century. And yet, so Prague was relatively tolerant, and all of these sort of splinter Protestant groups that were persecuted everywhere in Europe would come to Prague, and the Jews as well. So
did you, in honing in on this time period, and it does sound like you have done a lot of research that helped you frame that. But did you also find that there was something resonant about that time period that spoke to our contemporary situation?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, when I was working on it, a fellow crime writer, John Westerman, great guy, said, well, the only reason to write a historical novel is to comment on the present. And Some historical writers would not agree, but I would, of course, because of my perspective on that. So, you know, precisely. Well, I guess the most obvious one is, you know, the last Philomena novel appeared in 2002, and I spent 7 years, you know, I have a full-time job and an autistic son, so that takes up a lot of my time. But, you know, during that time, you know, during those 7 years, I was researching and writing this, and one thing that really struck me was, you know, the Germanic law codes of the 16th century actually say things like, you know, nobody should be convicted of a capital crime. You know, we're going to take someone's life, you know, without due process, which was surprising. You think, oh, the Middle Ages, you know, they're right there. They don't have that sort of thing. So, you know, they say this. They say, you know, nobody shall be deprived of their rights and their life without due process. Well, except, of course, for witches.
I've been talking with award-winning mystery writer Kenneth Wishnia. This is KRCB's A Novel Idea. We'll be right back. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it's KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'm talking with award-winning mystery writer Kenneth Wishnia on, among other things, his latest novel, The Fifth Servant.
So for you as a writer to move into this sort of territory, it does seem like a complete different process, to require a different process of you than these other books you've written. And I imagine that's a challenge and also an opportunity for you to grow as a writer with your craft.
Oh, absolutely. I even emailed a close friend, a very successful writer, S.J. Roseanne, who's won every crime award out there and in many countries as well. But I emailed her during this process saying, did you have this happen to you? Because she had a series that was going, then she did step aside to do some standalones, because I just thought, you know, okay, I'm going to try something different and challenge myself. But I had no idea how much of a challenge it would be doing a different era. Also, it's my first male protagonist.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, you would think that, he's a, you know, prematurely graying Jewish male with some, you know, issues in his life. So you would think, oh, that would be so much closer to who I am than this Ecuadorian-American woman. But it was much harder to get the voice down, I think in part because I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, give a man a mask and he will tell you the truth. And so putting on the mask of being an Ecuadorian woman actually – and she speaks in the first-person present tense directly to the reader. So, you know, that just – it's sort of like a stand-up comedy act, and I can do that. It's like Lenny Bruce shooting zingers out into the audience. And this character really demanded – in a way, he is much closer to my experience, even though it's 4 centuries ago. And I really had to dig much deeper, and it was the hardest thing I've ever written, but you know, I'm very, very proud of it. But you know, I will say the first draft of 23 Shades of Black was 90 to 95% of what I wanted. The first drafts of Chapters of the Fifth Servant were at best 50%, and I just had to throw out tons of stuff. And you know, I have this fabulous visual, which doesn't work on the radio, but let's just say I have a photo of myself leaning on the 42-inch high pile of drafts for this novel. You know, it's like 14 drafts of 600 pages.
When did you know you had it right? Or maybe, yeah, really. Maybe you know, for every writer, maybe there's a growing stack. You just have to decide when to.
Well, in this case, I actually did about 11 drafts that got me my new agent. She made me do a 12th, and then my agent, my editor at HarperCollins, had me do 2 more. And I guess, no, I do have an answer. I knew I was getting there when, you know, as I say, early on I was cutting tons of stuff that wasn't working. You're cutting the garbage. You're cutting the chaff. And by the end, I was cutting good stuff. You know, this is good, it's polished, but yeah, it doesn't belong here. It's interrupting the flow. It's just me.
Yeah.
I want to make this great line that I have fit in. And yes,
sometimes it just doesn't, huh?
And, you know, I guess...
Did you work tightly with your editor on that? Or is that something you do yourself?
Well, you do a lot yourself, but yes, in fact, for the Fifth Serve, I'm very fortunate to have a terrific editor, Jennifer Braille at William Morrow. And yes, as I said, she made me do two full revisions, which, you know, a house like Morrow has time for that.
So I'm going to bring it back to your first initial experience.
Sure.
That what a difference in the early observations you experienced early on as a writer, and then to have this very successful relationship with an editor and publisher. So that is a journey for you as a writer, and I think we as readers will enjoy continuing to watch where you go. So do you have something in the works right now?
Well, I will say that, the Fifth Servant actually marketed as fiction, not crime fiction. Publishers Weekly put it in the fiction section. So, that is an issue. When I finished this massive work, I do tell people it was like building a cathedral by myself. That's what it felt like.
So you're still coming down from that experience.
Well, starting with hewing the limestone from the quarry myself. And so after that, I did a bunch of short stories. I was invited to be in anthologies, and that was a lot of fun. I wasn't ready to commit yet. And now I'm at the point where I'm pretty deep into the research for the next one, and I need to, obviously, if I'm invited to be in an anthology, I do have some story ideas sitting there that I can develop. But it's going to be another, Jewish-themed historical, but I'm planning a parallel story, modern and ancient, to further heighten this issue of, yes, I'm actually commenting on the present, without being too heavy-handed, though. But yes, I've always been interested, in the medieval Renaissance period, thanks to, my mother's research and all of her work, but for whatever reason, also always been interested in, the ancient period, ancient Egypt, Persia, Babylon, and again, it's sort of, the Israelites, that fits right in. So, I'm going way back, which presents many challenges, of course. There's a lot more holes in the data. Yet a little more freedom. I can make up more, too, because, even though The Fifth Serving takes place in Prague in 1592, I'm using a lot of real characters. Rabbi Lowe is a real person, and I read a number of his works in translation so that I knew at least... Okay, he could have said this. He could have done this. You just don't want somebody doing something or being somewhere that they won't. I had to read two books about Emperor Rudolf II just to get his personality right for the 10-page scene where he appears.
So why don't we give our readers a flavor of the book? Why don't you share with us a little bit from your latest book, The Fifth Servant?
What a nice idea. And then I definitely have something to comment about that. But sure. So, one of the things they do in the business is, you're expected to be able to sum up your book in 20 seconds. In Hollywood, they call it the elevator pitch. The short version is it's Easter week, 1592, in Prague. The body of a Christian child is found in a Jewish shop, and the Jews are given 3 days to deliver the guilty party, or the whole ghetto is threatened with annihilation. And we'll do some reversing there, but I'll read first, and then we can talk a little bit about it. So, a distant cry woke me. I sat up and looked out the attic window over the sloping rooftops on the north side of Broad Street, which the German-speaking Jews call the Breitgasse. It was too early to see the horizon. The city and sky were an inseparable mass of darkness, and the scream's dying echoes evaporated into the air like the breath I could see coming out of my mouth. I was in bed with two strange men, the mikveh attendant and the street cleaner, and the room was damn near freezing. It was spring by the calendar, but it was still winter at heart, and I could feel in my bones that it was going to rain, like it did every year on the Christian holiday of Good Friday. I'd have bet 5 gold pieces on it, but there weren't any takers, and I didn't have 5 gold pieces. If you turned out my pockets, all you'd get for your troubles would be a few lonely coppers and some mighty fine lint imported all the way from the Kingdom of Poland. But something had jarred me awake. Like it says in the Megillus Esther, the king found no rest, so I listened intently, the fog of sleep still swirling around in my head. Muffled and ghostly, a distant cry floated over the narrow streets of the Jewish town.
Goethe!
Goosebumps rose on my arms as if the spirit of God had blown right past me and withdrawn from the room. If a Christian child was missing from its bed, we were sure to be accused, and all of a sudden I was reduced to being just another Jew in a city that tolerated us, surrounded by an empire full of people who hated us. Did I come all the way from the quiet town of Slonim just to get butchered by a bunch of Latter-day Crusaders? And if the Jews got scattered, or worse, I might never see my wife Razel again. Acosta's shadow filled the doorway. "Hey, newcomer, schlaf gicher, mit auf die Bett gewandt. Sleep faster, I need the sheet," said the night watchman, his rough-edged Yiddish softened by the rolling R's and open vowels of his Sephardic accent. "Did you hear that shouting?" I asked, planting my feet on the cold floor. "Any trouble out there?" "You just stick to your morning rounds and let the watchman handle it, all right?" My knees cracked as I stood up and groped around in the darkness for the pitcher and basin. 7 people crammed into 2 beds, 3 men in one, a family of peasants in the other, partly yearly crush of country folk visiting the imperial city for the week from Shabbos HaGadol to Pesach. The country folk had washed their bodies for the great Sabbath the week before, but their clothes still had the overripe tang of a barn full of animals. The night watchman took it all in and said, "What, there wasn't room for the goat?" I had to cover my mouth to keep from laughing. It wasn't good to joke around until I'd chased away the evil spirits that had settled on my hands during the night and said the first prayers of the new day. Fortunately, the rabbi in Slonim had taught me how to get rid of the invisible demons by washing them off my hands in a basin of standing water. Every year on Shabbos HaGadol we listen to the Lord's words to his servant Malachi. "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord." Then we watch and wait for a mysterious stranger who appears around this time of year and asks to be seated at the Seder. And woe to the family that turns the stranger away from their door, because he just might be the herald of the Messiah himself. Such is the faith that has guided us through so many narrow scrapes. When the Romans destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, we rebuilt the temple out of words and called it the Talmud, a temple of ideas that we can carry around with us wherever we go. And so we outlasted the Roman Empire. And we'll outlast this empire, too. The watchman pulled off his boots, grabbed his share of the blanket, and was snoring by the time I faced the eastern wall and said my morning Shema. I paid special attention to the part about teaching your children the word of God in order to prolong your days and the days of your children. Halfway down the crooked stairs to the kitchen, I could hear Pearl, a rabbi's wife, issuing orders to the servants to scour the house for chometz, the last traces of leavened bread. So there were no oats or porridge or kasha to keep my stomach from growling, only a mug full of chicken broth and some stringy dried prunes. Hannah the cook shouldn't waste a good piece of meat on the new assistant shamus. I warmed my fingers on the tin mug while pots clattered and doors slammed all around me. Despite the noise, I overheard Avram Chaim, the old shamus, telling the cook, "What do we need a fifth shulklopper for? Like a wagon needs a fifth wheel." But, wonder of wonders, Hannah actually stood up for me and told the old man that the great Rabbi Judah Lowe knew what he was doing. She had heard that the new man from Poland was a scholar and a scribe who'd only been in Prague a few days, without a right of residency, when the great Rabbi Lowe had seen a spark of promise in him and made him the Unterschamus at the Klaus Schule, the smallest of the 4 schules that served the ghetto's faithful. Maybe Hannah was thinking of her own husband, dead these many years, because she ended up stirring the ladle around the big pot and giving me a boiled chicken neck. I thanked her for this, one of the first signs of kindness anyone in this strange new place had shown me. I sucked the bones dry, then went to the mirror to clean the schmaltz off my beard and noticed with some resignation a few prematurely gray hairs curling around my temples. But I thought of the disembodied screams that had roused me from my bed, and suddenly a few gray hairs didn't seem like such a bad thing. I found the master putting on his short tallis. "What should we do, Rabbi? Should we prepare for an assault?" "Just attend to your duties, Benjamin ben Akiva," he answered. "God will show us the way in due time." So I grabbed the big wooden club and went to chase the spirits out of the shul.
That's Kenneth Wishnia reading from his award-winning book, The Fifth Servant. So has it been published in Italian, and has it been published in other languages then?
Spanish and Italian, oddly enough, not in Czech, not in German. I want it in German, damn it. And other languages. But
well, that's pretty good. They liked it over there.
But yes. And, you know, I guess, you know, so much occurs even this in this early bit. But one key thing I would say is that I have found I wrote it for as broad an audience as possible. I definitely had this, you don't have to be Jewish to read this book ethic going. As you can see, whenever when I speak Yiddish, I translate it right after. When I introduce a term in Hebrew or Yiddish, I translate it right after. And yet I have had Christian readers who said, it gets off to a bit of a slow start, but, you know, once it gets going, it's good. And, you know, the Jews get it right away. You know, it's Good Friday. Even though it's the Renaissance, people still have medieval attitudes. And, if a child is missing, we're in big trouble. And, you know, that's half a page into the book, I established that. And so, yeah, you know, the Jews get it right away. And other, you know, not everyone, but, you know, there are people who just don't seem to get that, you know, existential threat to the entire populace, is revealed on page one.
But that they get into a rhythm of it eventually is a testament to you as a writer that you're able to pull them in despite the perhaps cultural lack of knowledge.
Right. I mean, you know, there's so many things that I had to, you know, I rewrote this part, you know, 50 times because, yeah, it's your opening and that's what everyone sees. And actually, at one point, you know, when I was floundering around looking for an agent, a fairly high-powered agency in New York said, okay, sure, send us the first 5 pages. That's what they want, you know, 5 manuscript pages, you know, so that's, you know, nothing. You know, they want to decide based on that. You know, so I threw in a few things. One historical fact that I knew to be accurate was, you know, the ghetto was very crowded. And yes, before Passover, it got even more crowded. And that, of course, you would cram people into beds. But I figured saying I was in bed with 2 strange men would get your attention.
It did.
In the second paragraph there. You know, it turns out that it's just, you know,
because
it's just
that's
crowding.
The way they slept.
It's just crowding. And then, in fact, yeah, the night watchman comes in and says, okay, get out of my spot. You know, my turn. And that was certainly something I went for because, you know, one thing you want right away is you want your audience to empathize with the character. And I'm thinking, okay, yeah, he's a rabbinical scholar from 16th century Poland, and he's out of place. You know, I always have my characters who are out of place and outsiders and marginalized. Gee, why is that? But, you know, so one of the things I did was, you know, it's Central Europe, so March is still very cold, and I just figured, well, nobody likes getting out of bed. You know, when it's still dark in the middle of winter and the floor is cold, you know, everyone's going to relate to that. It doesn't matter that it's Prague in the 16th century. So, you know, I made sure to do that and then showed that, oh, and there's all this hectic activity. So there's not even breakfast for him.
I'm sure it is a challenge to have a contemporary enough voice to communicate with the listeners, with the readers, but then to have that historical exoticness that also pulls the readers in as well. Well, Ken, I want to thank you for joining us here in the studio today, and I wish you all the best with your book.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I have been talking with award-winning crime writer Kenneth Wishnia. We have production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. You can listen to our podcasts at krcb.org. Subscribe and listen anytime, anywhere. Thanks for listening today. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea.